Hey everyone, and welcome to part one of the Risky Biz Snake Oilers podcast for June. My name's Patrick Gray. Snake Oilers is the show we do here at Risky.biz where vendors pay to come on to talk about their tech. But I will tell you this, we've got three distinct technologies that we're talking about today, and I know that they will be of interest. Like, each one is going to be of interest to at least a portion of the listeners, right? Every single one of the technologies we're talking about today solves problems for some people. The question really is, are you one of the people who this stuff solves problems for? So I'm going to break it down really quickly. First up in this edition, we're going to talk to Rapid7 about its Insight IDR platform. I'll give you a full intro on that in a minute. After that, we've got the simplest pitch in this podcast. We're talking to Airlock Digital. They're an Australian company that makes whitelisting software that is actually usable. If your organization has tried implementing whitelisting through like Microsoft's AppLocker, then you know how badly it sucks. You know how badly AppLocker sucks and you know how hard it is. Airlock Digital have created a simple but usable whitelisting solution. I have been to the booth. I have seen the demo. Airlock Digital co-founder David Cottingham is our guest on their behalf this week. And in addition to being a founder of that company, David is also the author of the SANS course SEC 480, which covers the ASD top four. Number one on that list is whitelisting. He has experience in the federal government here implementing whitelisting. And, after seeing just how badly other products and approaches suck, he and his mates founded Airlock Digital. So yeah, if you're whitelist curious or if you're sick of dealing with AppLocker, then you really, really should listen to that one. After that, we're checking in with Stefan Chanet of Attack IQ. They make attack simulation software. Most of you would know that. But in response to customer demand, they've sort of taken it to its logical extension. They're now offering modules you can use to test your SOC staff. Or if you outsource, you can use these modules to test your MSSP. Throw some alerts at them. Throw some attack traffic at your network and, see if the phone rings, basically. And you can even get scores for individual SOC operators, things like that. You know, even if you are an MSSP, you might want to use this software to see, who to promote in your SOC. Use it to spot, talent. That's a really interesting idea. It's interesting stuff, and that's coming up later. But first up, as I mentioned, we're speaking with Rapid7. Listeners of the regular weekly show would have heard me talk about Rapid7's user insight software over the last, 5 years. And that's because I knew people who used it and they swore by it. User Insight was a user and entity behavior analytics software package that was, when it was released, it was massively ahead of its time. It was very good at spotting weird things happening on your network when it came to dumped or compromised creds popping up in weird places. And it was just very, very good at spotting lateral movement. Well, Insight IDR is basically what User Insight wound up becoming. And it's sort of morphed into a product that's half SIEM and half EDR. Now, every Tom, Dick, and Harriet seems to be offering EDR software these days, and every next-gen SIEM company is becoming more and more UEBA-centric. So what Rapid7 has created here is, in my view, it's kind of something in between. It's got shades of both. Now, unlike other EDR players or IDR players, they haven't tried to displace AV. They will work with AV from an orchestration and monitoring perspective instead. And unlike other SIEM providers, they're not trying to capture the kitchen sink, just the information they require to generate high-value signals. Now, they sell this stuff as software or as a service, through their own SOC. There's more on that in the interview. But honestly, I've always liked Rapid7's approach to these types of problems because the approach genuinely is just a little bit different. Anyway, here's Eric Sun, the product manager for Insight IDR. And as he explains, creating a good security product can be as simple as asking pen testers how they win and then working backwards from there. Here he is.
We asked our pen testers how they get in, and we reverse engineered the data sources required to detect those attacks. And so we also even include things like honeypots, and there's a couple other deception technologies. We inject dummy credentials on the endpoint. So if somebody uses Mimikatz or some other scraper, we'll be able to identify that type of attack as well.
So you got a few like dodgy service accounts there that look pretty tempting, do you?
Yeah. So we also have the honey users for patch admin accounts that you can layer on your network.
Yeah.
Honeypots for the network scans. So we've got really some fun stuff here. And then we've even made it so that our managed detection response analysts can contribute detections too. So
yeah.
When they see a new threat, they can write a detection based on whatever data they want to match it against. And then it gets pushed out to the product. And because it's cloud, automatically gets matched against the customer too. So that agile detection framework is, we can really do this whole process quickly.
How is your EDR different? Because it's such a crowded space. I mean, I know I'm out there, essentially selling advertising services to security companies, and it seems like 50% of the security market is EDR. How do you even begin to differentiate yourself with an EDR tool?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the biggest challenges is that EDR takes a good amount of expertise. It quickly gets really challenging for teams. And so certainly managed EDR is on the rise. So the way that we differentiate is we make sure that the alerts we generate have that user and network context as well. So if there's lateral movement, you have multiple ways of identifying that, not just the authentications on the endpoint. And so we're also making it easier to use by whenever there's a new detection we release for EDR, whether it be something like PowerShell spawning off of a Office document or any kind of stealthy behavior, we also include recommendations and guidance that's added by our threat intelligence teams. So we want to make the barrier to investigate and remediate just that much lower for security teams that don't have dedicated folks that have this domain knowledge for endpoints.
Now, I understand that you have a lot of success in the 1,000 to 10,000 employee range. What is it that, why is it that people are choosing you over other SIEM platforms? Because there's also, like EDR, it's sort of becoming a crowded space. I can think of 5 or 6 major players. And everyone's stuff these days, it's crazy, right? Because I never thought I'd say this, but most people's stuff these days is pretty good. Some of it's looking a little bit creaky. I think, stuff like Splunk, stuff like ArcSight, it's like, why would you buy it in 2018? But there are other viable alternatives. So what's actually winning deals for you?
Yeah, so certainly our free trial has been driving a lot of our business because we're giving folks the opportunity to test it in their environment. And in nearly all cases, they're getting up and running immediately. And so they're getting up in hours, they're able to get the visibility, identify misconfigurations, and they're finding that it's easy to use. So I'd say, SIEM, when you think of SIEM, it's often hard, and think of only a couple use cases to start off with, start slow. They're finding that they can do a lot really quickly, and that's really been a great seller for us.
Okay, so talk me through that ease then, right? Because SIEM usually is about connecting just a million different data sources and then working to contextualize everything. And it's, they're big projects. It seems like what you're pitching here is a SIEM where you're like, here's an endpoint agent that does UEBA, and we're going to call that a SIEM, but I'm guessing you're plugging in other data sources as well. So what other data sources are you actually plugging into your SIEM that makes this not just an EDR play?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's Active Directory, there's LDAP, there's DHCP, and there's also the Insight Agent. And so this gives us insight into authentications, user behavior, but from there they can add other sources like firewall, web proxy, IDS, but the main sources are the ones that tell us what users are doing and the services that they're interacting with.
So this is still extremely user-centric.
Yes.
Yeah.
And we start with that because organizations have a really hard time retracing user behavior as they jump between IP addresses, addresses, their assets, their cloud services, and so on and so forth.
Now, I believe you say that this tech is suitable for organizations that have a SOC and organizations that don't have a SOC. I'm guessing, though, that if you've got a SOC already, I mean, a lot of that data is already going to be getting pumped in there, and this is more just about maybe dropping a good UEBA component on top. And in the cases that people don't have a SOC, is that so that they can then, use Rapid7 as an MSSP? Because I understand quite a lot of your customers actually, buy this as a managed service. I mean, how are those two different classes of organizations, like the SOC and the SOCless, how are they using this?
So let's start with the SOCless. Certainly with the security talent shortage and some of that domain expertise that we touched on, they're looking for Rapid7 to monitor their network and go beyond the traditional MSSP. So there's been a lot of pain in the industry about an MSSP aggregating the alerts, maybe doing a little bit of validation, but sending a report over with these alerts for the customer to perform investigation. And that's pretty challenging because there are still too many alerts, and oftentimes the customers find, this is stuff I already know about or I'm already working on. Mm-hmm. And so with the MDR service, I'd say some of the key components are the fact that we'll do 24/7 monitoring and we'll perform full investigations for any of the alerts, for all of the alerts generated by the technology.
And what do those investigations look like? Because that's interesting, right? You look at the Target breach, and they had some outsourced partner running their FireEye gear. The FireEye gear caught the attack. Someone emailed an alert somewhere. It dropped into an inbox, and that was that. You know, their whole infrastructure wound up being compromised. So when you say you investigate alerts, to what depth do you actually do that as a managed service?
The key here is definitely the data collection. And so that's why we focus on making it really easy and making it so that the customer doesn't have to worry about managing that data. And so our MDR analysts have access to all of the information available through Insight IDR, and they can also perform forensics tasks using the Insight agent. And so that can certainly look into parent-child processes, registry, scheduled tasks. And so we have a full incident response team and consultants at Rapid7. So we have those experts available for investigation as well as any escalations. Breach escalations are also included with our MDR service.
That's interesting, right? Because like everything that you're talking about, which is spotting funny user behavior and then being able to pull up, you know, process trees and things like that, it's just such bread and butter stuff. And it's always amazed me that more companies don't focus on stuff like that, even in the detection component when it comes to things like, you know, like where your processes came from. You can learn a lot from that.
Yeah, it's really tough. I mean, even when we think of traditional threat intelligence, you need to be collecting the right data, you need to buy the right relevant threat intel feed, you need to mesh all these systems together, and then interpret the results. And so there's so many stages to this. With our MDR service, you know, we provide nearly all of that cycle to customers, so they don't have to worry about that.
Yeah. And I guess because you don't have your own people in your SOC sitting there going through like, you know, signature matches, they can spend their time actually focusing on real stuff and you're less likely to get SOC fatigue.
Yeah. On that note, our MDR analysts are fully equipped to contribute their own detections. And so certainly as they have to parse through the alerts that Insight IDR generates.
If they see something that's tripping, they go, okay, let's tune it a bit, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So what does a typical alert look like? It might be like this user has logged in somewhere they've never logged in before. Is that usually the type of alert that's going to trip up?
So there's definitely these basic user behavior analytics that are very valuable. So a user that's logging in from two locations, I log in from Boston, 15 minutes later, there's an authentication from France, from my Office 365. And so since we're watching both network, endpoint, and cloud services, we're creating these entities of all of these accounts that I regularly use. We know that it's one person. So that helps us catch the use of stolen credentials. But there's also a nuanced example would be maybe I use a valid credential to access the finance server. But in this case, I'm doing it from an asset that I've never authenticated to before. We'll still alert on that because we have all of that data and we know even though Ericsson is a valid user to the finance server, he's still doing it from a suspicious asset.
So you mentioned Office 365. That's interesting. And you mentioned a lot of cloud services. What I think is interesting, I think, early on with your UEBA, it was very much Windows-centric. But these days, you've really got it looking at cloud resources as well, which, I mean, you know, you're not the only one doing that. But how much good data does that give you? I'd imagine a fair bit because so much stuff is cloud now, even, you know, essential, you know, functions like Office and whatever.
So certainly cloud vendors have expanded their security APIs significantly. So yeah. We work with vendors like Salesforce, Google Apps, Box.com. And so we're getting that authentication data as well as privileged actions. So admin actions that are being taken, account created, account deleted. And so that's all meshing into the user behavior profiles we're creating for every user in the organization.
All right, let's wrap it up there. Eric Sun, thank you very much for joining us to talk about Insight IDR, which is, you know, as I've mentioned, it's kind of that logical extension of user insight, which I think is now, you don't call it user insight anymore, do you?
Right, it's all evolved and all bundled into Insight IDR.
So there you go. It's now Insight IDR from Rapid7. As you mentioned, free trial, right? So that's it. Like customers can just go and trial this, like as a managed service or just the software?
So the software is fully available for a 30-day trial. In fact, they can go to rapid7.com/snakeoilers.
Hey, there we go.
Quick navigation to the trial.
Lead tracking. Everybody go hit that link now. Eric Sun, thank you very much for joining us.
Awesome. Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
That was Eric Sun there of Rapid7. And yeah, you can head over to rapid7.com/snakeoilers to get yourself an eval copy of that software. And please do use that link too, so that they know that you heard about them on the Snake Oilers podcast. Now, the second vendor in this part of the June Snake Oilers is Airlock Digital. And what I love about this tech is how simple it is. They make a whitelisting platform. That's it. And the reason they make a whitelisting platform is because, you know, despite whitelisting being very powerful, the InfoSec market, the vendor market, is, you know, usually too busy selling everyone threat intelligence feeds about North Korean APT crews instead of actually tackling meat and potatoes controls like whitelisting. And there are many organizations that simply have to roll out whitelisting. In Australian federal government departments, you know, it's mandatory. It's the number one control mandated by the Australian Signals Directorate. And on the private sector side, a lot of companies out there got hit pretty hard by ransomware despite having antivirus. So, you know, whitelisting has been seen as a solution to that, and a lot of projects have kicked off. But everybody's had the same problem, which is whitelist tools are, by and large, terrible. Our next guest, David Cottingham, worked for the federal government here in Australia, and it was his job to implement whitelisting at a large department. It was so fiddly, he wound up writing a SANS course about it. And I think after teaching that course for a while, he got the same feedback over and over. Why is this so hard? So from there, the idea became pretty obvious. He and his compadres would build a simple product that actually does this stuff competently, and that's where Airlock Digital came from. Here's David Cottingham of Airlock Digital talking whitelisting.
Application whitelisting actually seems like a really simple concept, right? Like choose the files that you trust and block everything else. But when you get into the detail and you actually try and implement it, there's so many little and also big challenges. And the people that have tried to use AppLocker and then sort of come along for a demo really get what we're trying to do when we show them. And just really through the simplicity and the fact that we're solving a lot of the typical AppLocker challenges. We came from a techo background. So, I mean, we went through all the difficulties of learning all the hard challenges ourselves. So basically, I was working for a federal government agency back in 2011 in Canberra, and we were tasked with implementing application whitelisting as technical operations people ourselves. And what we did was we implemented in the environment software restriction policies, had challenges, then went through implementing AppLocker, had challenges there. It didn't really meet our sort of usability requirements and also security requirements. And then ditched that and then went on to doing augmentation of other endpoint protection solutions to try and make them do application whitelisting. And we were building a lot of wrappers around those tools to try and make them usable. But there were still shortcomings, we found. So eventually we took all the learnings from that and then basically decided that we have to build an agent to solve this problem. And that turned into what Airlock is today.
Now, it seems that the driver, the main commercial driver for most of your customers seems to be that they have AV and they were still getting ransomware. And, you know, while AV tools have got better at spotting it, I mean, they don't guarantee that a user isn't going to do something stupid. And I think that's where this whitelisting stuff is probably most useful. We can mention too that the department you're working for is the Department of Industry. And, you know, it's unusual to find too many environments where whitelisting is something that is kind of being pushed by, you know, in a compliance sense. But of course, being an Australian federal government agency, you're kind of being pushed by ASD to do this. That's right, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. So ASD released this basically this strategy list in 2011 called the Top 35 Mitigation Strategies. And the top strategy on that was application whitelisting. And it was mandatory for all federal government agencies to do it. And I guess at the time we realized that we needed to come up with a solution to this challenge was there was about, you know, 20 different government agencies all trying to do application whitelisting. And there was no sort of middle level knowledge about how we should be successful with doing it. And a lot of people were running with AppLocker. And so what I actually did before Airlock was I wrote a SANS course, which is called Implementing and Auditing the Top Four. And we spent, it was a three-day course. We spent 2 out of 3 days talking to students about application whitelisting. And students kind of came away thinking, yeah, I have more knowledge now, but it still seems really difficult. Because in the course, I was basically talking about all the wrappers and the things that I'd made to try and make it usable. And I just want to see more people being successful around the place, basically. And we needed to build a framework to do that.
Yeah. So, you know, you keep talking about the challenges. What were they really? Because, and then we'll get into the pitchy part where we actually talk about how your product works. Because, you know, what I find really compelling about what you do is that it is pretty simple, right? You've made it pretty damn easy. But, you know, just walk us through what those challenges are. Because they're, in my mind, they're just challenges that shouldn't be there in any attempt at whitelisting. And yet, here we are.
Yes, yeah, I completely agree. I'm surprised that we're here, to be honest, solving this problem. But basically, one of the biggest challenges is really just getting the visibility and being able to action on the events, right? So you have, let's say you have one computer and you take a baseline of that computer. In a normal operating sense, that computer will drift. Users will bring in new applications. You'll need to patch it, update, you know, and files will change. The biggest challenge I've had with whitelisting solutions is I don't get really clear understanding of what has actually drifted at scale across the enterprise. And when I get that information, I need to be able to action that really, really quickly and push those changes back down to endpoints. Because if you're getting files blocked and you're not resolving them, then you can cause a usability impact effectively. So it was basically the biggest challenge was just getting that level of visibility and being able to turn that around very, very quickly and update the endpoints.
So, I mean, these problems were more on the console side than the endpoint side, right?
100%. There's a lot of software out there on the market that allows you to block or not block files effectively, but it's about how you do that. So part of the challenge of application whitelisting, especially if you're doing it in a really secure, granular manner, is you're typically dealing with thousands, if not tens of thousands of files at any given time. So how do you sort of stand on the end of that fire hose of files and information, process that in a manner that has integrity, and then allow those files to execute on the endpoints.
Well, and this is where it gets interesting, right? And this is where whitelisting has always kind of fallen down, is that people have to all of a sudden make, you know, trust decisions at volume, right? And that is quite hard. So I guess you've built some smarts into the console to kind of handle that, because these days you're actually providing reputation scoring on files that are new to the environment. And that's coming from Reversing Labs, right?
Yeah, absolutely. We've got a partnership with the Reversing Labs that gives us file reputation. But I should make the distinction that one of the things that the ASD says is that whitelisting rules cannot be provided by a third party effectively. So you cannot use cloud-based trust in order to define your rule set, because part of the security that comes from application whitelisting is the fact that it's purpose-built and customized to your environment.
Well, and so it's also forcing someone to actually make the call, right? Which is why you can't just outsource that trust decision to a third party, right?
Absolutely. So it's about building the framework to allow you to make that trust decisions internally in a way that's security intensive or requires a lot of security skill, because and that's a big challenge.
That's where we arrived, right?
Yeah, most of our time in development is how do we make this as simple as possible, to be honest?
Because it's funny, we've seen big time sort of whitelisting plays. I mean, Bit9 was all over the place for a while, and then they sort of wound up becoming Carbon Black, and that was their success story. Yep. They sort of abandoned whitelisting as a primary business strategy. And I think, you know, there's some reasons for that. I think they kind of got owned and their certificate stolen, and their customers had a pretty bad time, right? Which is never good for business. But you know, it's always come down to that challenge, hasn't it, is making it usable. So why do you think you can succeed where others have failed in terms of the usability aspect?
Yeah, I think we're purpose-built and focused on performing application whitelisting as our sole focus. So one of the things that I had, which was a challenge with a lot of endpoint protection products that are trying to do 20 different things, is they sort of lost focus on performing one particular strategy. So the application whitelisting component really got buried in a lot of other features, and it made it sort of really a bit clunky and hard to use. So that's why previously in the federal government, I had to put wrappers around the outside of those products to build workflows to make it work. Because whitelisting is a big part of it is having a business workflow. So it's understanding the customers that are using it, how people are deploying and updating software inside the organization, and being able to catch those key events and then validate them and then update the whitelist to trust those patches and the way the organization works. So
I think what it comes down to is that you were tasked with doing this and you didn't find anything that could do it, right?
Yeah, effectively.
Yeah,
absolutely.
And okay, so we should talk about that too, because, you know, in any business, right, you're going to have people upgrading software, right? Say it's their ERP client or whatever it is, right? Is it the situation with your whitelisting product that they've rolled an upgrade and, you know, or it's happened overnight automatically or something, they come into work and they can't load their ERP software and they're going to be ringing the security team saying, turn it back on? I mean, that is where you're going to wind up with whitelisting, right?
Not always, but I guess if you did wind up there, let's say you configured your rule set badly and you had lots of blocks, you want to be able to log in somewhere, see exactly what's happened and fix that straight away.
Well, that's kind of what I was driving at, which is as long as that's quickly and easily resolvable, it's not so much of a problem.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's being able to action that information. So, and also we find that out there in the enterprise, the majority of people that are actually doing application whitelisting don't have a security background. So the security team in a typical organization will say, hey, operations, you need to do application whitelisting. And then they want the operations team to actually run it on a day-to-day basis. They don't want to sit there and make the decisions themselves. So, you know, it's about almost making a security tool that's not for security people, if that makes sense.
Oh, look, it totally makes sense. Because when I looked at your console, I'm like, I could train an intern on driving this thing, you know, like, and if there's an edge case, they can get in touch, but you've kind of solved that problem of like, and I know that version two, which wasn't that long ago, that was a few months ago. That's when you've put in like lookup information from reversing labs and whatever, just to help those line balls. I mean, you're going to see some stuff come in that, you know, that's dodgy, block it. And then those line ball cases, you can kind of do the lookups and go to external sources and try to drive that decision. But the general workaday stuff is just going to be yes, no, yes, no, yes, 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 and you're done.
Yes, absolutely. Yep. Yeah. And also we're doing a number of different things to try and make it easier for implementation or rapid implementation of whitelisting, because historically it takes a very long time. Like, for example, we'll identify problem products that our customers have inside the organization. And problem products are typically ones that we see that dynamically load files on systems. So they might update themselves, or they might, you know, it might be an antivirus product that whenever it downloads virus definitions, it loads files into memory. So how do you deal with that? So what we do is we continually sort of ship and update rules. So it says that if you use this product, you know, tick this, and then we will allow the dynamic component only of that product to do what it needs to do. But we'll also be fully transparent about the rules that we're using to do that. So we're not sort of locking that away.
So you can sort of give a bit of leeway here and there to products that require it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So .NET framework is a massive one that dynamically compiles files. So we'll ship, okay, you use .NET framework applications, you basically need to use these rules in order to allow these applications to run.
I like it too that you're catching, you know, anything that executes, like even PowerShell and stuff, right?
Yes, 100%. So we've got full scripting support. And one thing that the security community has really been talking about a lot lately is LOL bins, or living off the land bins. I think InfoSec Twitter has been blowing up over the last 3 months about people coming up with ways to circumvent application whitelisting. And we monitor all of that really, really closely and make sure that we're putting in protections to prevent those sort of bypass methods. So we're supporting really weird file types, you know, JavaScript, and weird XML-based files, PowerShell, VB script.
Well, there it is. There it is. David Cottingham, thank you very much for joining us on Snake Oilers to talk through your whitelisting solution. I wish you the best of luck with it, and I hope to have you back on again soon.
Thanks.
That was David Cottingham of Airlock Digital there. Do check them out at airlockdigital.com. Okay, it is time for our third and final pitch in this podcast now with Stefan Chenette of Attack IQ. Attack IQ would be familiar to Risky Business listeners. They've been on a few podcasts doing stuff, and yeah, they make an attack simulation platform. This is a relatively new product category that is actually taking off in 2018. Mostly it's very large organizations that are heading down the attack simulation road at this stage. But now there are people out there actually using this stuff. Stefan and his team are starting to get feature requests from users. So for those who are unfamiliar, Attack IQ's platform generates suspicious events on your network and then measures the response from your security product and security team. And that way you can spot misconfigurations, tune your defenses, and basically become very good at spotting real attacks in your environment. But what about the people who are responding to these alerts? The human link is always a weak one. So some of Attack IQ's customers ask them to help measure the effectiveness of individual SOC team members. They can take that information and sort out who is who in their SOC. So here's Stefan Chenette talking about this new feature of Attack IQ's platform.
Yeah, this particular use case for our platform was actually brought to us by an existing customer who was already using our platform to measure and test their technologies, the processes in between their technologies and their SIMs, and said, well, we want to actually introduce new workflows into your platform to test our SOC analysts. We want to deploy attack scenarios that have a relation to lateral movement and exfiltration, and then we want to measure our 50 SOC analysts for their ability to detect and time that historically, and then their skill set of the different techniques. So it's been really good.
I mean, it makes total sense, right? Because until now, your focus has been on making sure that the right information actually pops up in the SOC, right? Like, that's a big focus for Attack IQ, and to make sure everything's configured properly as well. But, you know, it's all well and good having the right alerts pop up on the right consoles, but if people aren't doing the right things with that information, then you're kind of back at square one.
Yeah, I mean, so our platform works in such a way that we can create adversarial simulations, and we have the ability to suppress that so that we're actually not creating more alerts for the SOC analyst. But what we've done is also added the ability to not suppress it so that we can run cyber hunt exercises and give the ability for the SOC team as a whole to improve all of their SOC analysts. So whether you're a new SOC analyst coming onto a team and not familiar with all the tools and technologies that going to help you do your everyday job, or you're a very mature organization, everyone wants to improve. And so by running these cyber hunt exercises, you can simulate various events in your network, on your devices, really look at what are the anomalous behaviors of most attackers given different situations, and then start measuring the skill set, measuring the mean time for response, the ability to recognize various exfiltration techniques. And so it really helps the SOC team as a whole, whether they're very early on in building up the SOC or more mature, historically improve over time and actually showcase that to the management team in order to show how they're improving.
So are you doing like, because I understand that quite often your output is something as simple as a star rating for a particular control. Is it similar for where you get like a sheet where you get like a star rating for different categories for each analyst?
Yeah, when we measure the different technologies, and a given organization might have 75 different technologies, it's all against the MITRE attack matrix. And so you'll actually get to see the efficacy and the mapping against the MITRE attack matrix. When we talk about SOC analyst, we can actually look at the mapping within the six tactics of the matrix, whether it be persistence or exfiltration, and actually understand where is most analysts historically better at recognizing anomalous events within the matrix. And so it's against the attack matrix from MITRE that we actually score the SOC analyst. And yeah, they have a certain score that they can improve on historically.
And I'm guessing a handful of customers are already using this. Have they actually found it useful in, you know, for as a managerial tool in the SOC?
I think that what they'll use it for is both when they're hiring new SOC analysts, to understand a baseline is what is the skill set. I mean, we used to do this when I was a consultant before Attack IQ was, let me actually run you through a capture the flag exercise. You might say that you're good at these X, Y, and Z skill sets, but until you actually get tested, you don't know what the skill set of a particular SOC analyst is. So in many cases, the SOC managers and directors are actually testing new SOC analysts to understand, well, what's the baseline? And then so they want to help them improve over time. That's the whole goal of a manager is help your team improve their skill set through running these exercises so that when there's a true attacker behavior in your network, you can better respond more effectively and understand your tool set that you have at your hand.
Now, it's been a couple of years since Attack IQ first appeared on Risky Business as a sponsor, and there's been a lot of movement in the attack simulation market. I mean, essentially, when you first appeared on this show, it wasn't a market yet. It just was not there. And this year we heard, I mean, at RSA back in April, as a category, it was starting to pick up a bit of buzz, and it seems that it's been carried along quite far by the overall push to orchestration and automation in enterprise. People who are pushing very heavily on that seem to be very, very interested in attack simulation because it's a lot easier to do when you've got your orchestration ducks in a row. I mean, is that a fair assessment of what's happened lately?
Yeah, I mean, as I walked around RSA this year, there was a few different themes, but they really came down to simplify security and automation. And so both the attack simulation and continuous validation space and the orchestration space, really play well with how do I help automate my SOC? How do I help automate the visibility that I have into my security stack? And so it's become extremely real for companies to the degree that it's now become a budgeted line item. When you're a Fortune 50, a Fortune 100, this is a priority now in your security program. This is a priority within the security team, and that's only going to start to trickle down into the Fortune 500 and Fortune 1000 and beyond. You got the real players who set the mark, though, as an example, doing this today.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great place to be, right? When you've just put years of your life into creating a technology for a market that didn't exist yet, having that turn into a budget line item for massive, you know, mega companies is always quite pleasing. Gartner has even jumped in and released a paper on attack sim. I mean, they don't have a magic quadrant yet, but I mean, it feels like that's where this is moving and that this is actually going to be a product category that sticks around.
Yeah, so a few weeks ago, Gartner released a paper on breach and attack simulation, BAS. You know, this is for us a use case on top of continuous security validation, but it's the use case that matters most right now to the organizations that we're talking to. And they're looking at how does adversarial simulation, mapping that to the MITRE attack matrix, help them really build up their security program. So that mapping is going to help them understand where are their gaps in their defensive controls, what are adversaries doing today, and what are the next steps of investment that they really need to be looking at against that matrix. And so the only way to do that is test for your gaps using our platform and then start filling your coverage in the MITRE attack matrix.
Well, I mean, being able to test the analysts as well, you know, which is what we were just talking about earlier. I mean, that really does close the loop in a pretty significant way, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, that's the next evolution. So when Attack IQ started, it was very focused on the technologies and the processes, say, you know, does the alerts that we create end up in your Carbon Black? Does Carbon Black properly flow that to, say, Splunk or QRadar? And the natural evolution was, well, it's about testing your people, process, tools, and technologies, the people being the first one, those SOC analysts that are really monitoring all of those tools and technologies. So you look at a lot of the various large data breaches and the tools might have been doing their job. The technology might have been detecting or preventing, but if the analysts aren't there responding, then the entire program falls apart. And so everything has to work together. So it's very important to measure your SOC analyst and help them improve over time.
Now, I'd imagine there would be a few people listening wondering if they could throw some of this technology at their managed security provider, because that's one of the problems, isn't it? When you outsource this stuff, there's a lot of trust involved. And what do people say? You know, trust but verify. Is this a use case for the, you know, I know the module is called the Cyber Hunt Exercise module. Great buzzwording there. But is that kind of a use case that people can use this to test their MSSPs and make sure that they're not going to wind up, you know, getting owned and only finding out about it because Brian Krebs wrote about it?
Yes. So the organizations that we work with today, you know, range from large financials, healthcare, government, you know, utilities, and they either have internal teams that they want to help test and improve over time in their skill set, and many of them utilize the services of MSSPs, you know, either completely or partially to supplement their existing SOC. And yeah, it'll help them test that ability to see if the MSSP service that they're using is fully engaged and monitoring the events inside of their SOC. So yeah, we have seen that in our user base.
Now, look, one thing that I know you've been working on pretty hard, you know, certainly over the last year, is to really try to get a thriving user community happening behind Attack IQ. Now, the way that you've expressed it to me is that, you know, your technology tests people, processes, tools, and technologies. But, you know, fundamentally, this is content driven. So you're really trying to get an active user community to do things like, I'm presuming, establish and share attack scenarios that they might have found useful. Is that right?
Yeah, no, that's correct. I mean, communities aren't built overnight. What we've been fortunate enough to have is a very strong customer base that was really the seed of our community that contributed scenarios that were basically events that had been, you know, existent in a lot of our customer base. And those scenarios are the patterns of most of the attacker behavior, various, you know, sophisticated attackers or very common patterns. And then they were contributing to scenarios for the rest of our customer base and the rest of our community to use. And then those same scenarios are used to test the people, the process, the tools, and the technology. So scenarios are contributed into our community. Integrations are contributed into our community. It's growing, and it's certainly something that we put a lot of focus behind, and we reward a lot of our community members and our ambassadors within our community.
It's very hard to pull that one off. So if you're getting some traction there, you're doing something right. Stefan Chanet, thank you very much for joining us on Snake Oilers to walk us through the latest. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Patrick.
That was Stefan Chanet there of Attack IQ, and you can check them out at attackiq.com. And that is it for part one of the June Snake Oilers podcast. I do hope you've enjoyed it. I'll be back in the regular weekly show next week. But until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening. Bye.